Champagne Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 23rd annual Arts and Crafts Show and Sale on November 19th and 20th at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information at 367-9546.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This is hour number two of our program. And in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about twins and the kind of advantage that they give scientists in studying what is a very old question, the kind of thing that people have been debating for a long, long time. That question being, when we look at what determines human development and shapes the people that we are, what's more important? Is it our genetic inheritance or is it the environment in which we grow up? Our guest this morning, Nancy Siegel, has spent more than 15 years studying twins. And she says to that answer to that old question, the nature-nurture question is, well, she says it's both. We'll be talking about some of what you will find in her book, Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins. It's recently published by the Harvard University Press. It is one of two books that she's written that deal with this subject. The other is Entwined Lives, Twins and What They Tell Us About Human Behavior. That book came out in 1999. She is professor of developmental psychology and also director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University in Fullerton. And as I said, has been working in this area for quite a long time. She served as the assistant director of the Minnesota Center for Twin and Adoption Research. That's in the Department of Psychology at University of Minnesota, and spent a lot of time writing on this subject, doing research, giving talks. She's associate editor for the journal Twin Research and Human Genetics, contributing research editor for Twins magazine for a number of years, and also is a member of the advisory board for the Center for Loss in Multiple Birth. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening, of course, are welcome, like always. The only thing that we ask of people is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, everybody who is listening is welcome to join in the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So once again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana listeners here where we are, and toll free any place else, 800-222-9455. Professor Siegel, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Just great, thanks.
Well, thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it. I gather that one of the reasons that you are interested in studying twins is that you are a twin.
That's correct. I'm a fraternal twin. I have a sister, Anne, who looks and behaves nothing like me. And when I was a small child, I was fascinated by the fact that she and I were so different, and yet we shared the same parents, the same home, the same school, the same summer camp. And it occurred to me that there must have been something fundamentally different about us that explained these differences. And then when I began to study psychology in college, I realized that we came into the world with different packs of genes. And these genes led us to different people, different places, different events, different interests. And that explains why any two children in a family, whether they're fraternal twins or non-twins, can end up being so very different despite what seems to be a similar environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you early on make the point in the book that there are these two kinds of twins. There are those that we call identical, although you also make the point of obviously no one, even identical twins, are identical. And then there are the fraternal twins, and the main difference is how much of the same genetic material do they share?
Correct. Identical twins share all their genes in common, having split from a single fertilized egg between the first and 14th day after conception. But they're not as alike as most people think. Now, they are more alike than any other pair of people in whatever traits, physical or behavioral, we can measure. But still, the environment plays some amazing roles in carving out little differences in these genetically identical people. And the beauty of studying identical twins who differ in some way is that we can then start to identify the environmental events, either those before birth or after birth, that cause these differences, and then we can use that information to better understand development in the non-twin population.
Mm-hmm.
The fraternal twins share half their genes on average by descent, which is exactly the same that are shared by ordinary non-twin siblings in a family. And so here, nature provides us with this terrific natural experiment. If we compare identical twin similarity to fraternal twin similarity, we usually find that identical twins are more alike, whether it's in intelligence, body weight, body height, interests, personality. And this tells us that the genes play some role in the development of that trait.
Well, when you talked about the fact that fraternal, if you look at their genetic makeup, that fraternal twins are genetically not going to be any more alike than any other than other siblings.
Right.
Are. But then if you study fraternal twins and compare them to some other sample of brothers and sisters that are not twins, do you indeed though find that that the fraternal twins are more similar than your average than your other average sibling pairs?
Right. We do find that on intelligence and general mental ability, fraternal twins tend to be slightly more alike than ordinary non-twin siblings, and that may be because they come into the family at the same time, and they're chronologically matched, and they achieve their developmental milestones at the same time, and have probably had more similar educational experiences than children that come into the family at different points in time. But actually, sometimes what I find so fascinating is that I'll find fraternal twins who seem to be nothing alike, and yet one of those fraternals will be so much more like an older brother or sister. In fact, in my first book, I have a photograph like that where it seems like the wrong people have been born together. That's in the first chapter of Entwined Lives. It's really quite striking if anyone's interested.
The thing that I think fascinates a lot of people is indeed this question, the nature-nurture question, and what particularly studying identical twins can tell us, and particularly a certain group of them. And these are the kinds of things that often get so much attention in the popular media, and the kind of things that you and other researchers were involved in looking at in Minnesota. And that is this group of people, they're identical twins separated at birth.
Yeah.
What happens when you later look at those people who are genetically the same but were raised in different families? And I suppose the thing that really catches our attention is those cases, and you write about some of them in the books, where you have these people that were identical twins separated at birth, and then later on in life you get them together and you realize there are remarkable similarities in the directions that their lives have taken, sometimes in real significant ways, sometimes in ways that are perhaps less so. And it starts you asking questions about, again, this whole nature-nurture thing, and also about those, when you look at those similarities, which of those are really important and which of those maybe are, you know, for example, what kind of beer you like. You know, you just have to say, now, is that really important? But
drink beer. But I'll tell you, you're right. The identical twins raised apart are a fascinating group. And in my more recent book, Indivisible by Two, I chronicle the life histories of three of them in very detailed fashion. Let me tell you a little bit about those pairs. Mark and Jerry were reared apart in the state of New Jersey, maybe 20, 30 miles apart. And yet they still live very similar lives in ways that were unconnected to their families. For example, both of them ended up being volunteer firefighters, and both of them, when we met them in Minnesota when they were 31, both had similar jobs. One installed chemical fire suppression systems in hotels. The other one installed burglar alarm systems in restaurants. They both had this penchant for Budweiser beer, and they had to hold the can with a pinky finger underneath. And they both wore big belt buckles and big belts and lots of key rings dangling from the side, and had similar interests in music, intelligence scores maybe 1 or 2 points apart. So they were amazingly similar, as were Brent and George, a pair of twins separated at birth in Ottawa, And even a pair of twins with, I think, the most dramatic differences in their rearing, Jack and Oscar. Jack and Oscar were born in Trinidad in 1933 to a Jewish father and a Catholic mother. And when the parents' relationship soured when the boys were 6 months old, Jack was raised Jewish by his father in Trinidad, but the mother took Oscar back with her to Germany, and he was in the Hitler Youth League. But when we saw those twins at age 45 in Minnesota, despite the fact that their historical and political understandings were quite different, they were remarkably similar in the way they spoke, in the way they moved, in their personality profiles. It's just that the content of some of their behaviors was different, but the basic personality styles and argumentative manner was so strikingly similar. So what we think happens, David, is that our genes predispose us towards similar or certain events, certain people, certain places. Not that our genes determine where we go. We have a range of opportunities that we can pick from. Many of us would be happy at numerous kinds of jobs, and many of us probably have skills that we don't even know about simply because opportunities weren't there. But what we're saying is that within the range of opportunities available to us, we become attracted to certain sorts of things. So even though identical twins raised apart seem to be in objectively different environments, they craft their own environment to make it similar in similar ways.
Hmm. This is the kind of case that will, it's a great story, will catch your attention. And although I guess I find myself wondering how common it is, and it may indeed be the pool of research subjects may not be very big. I don't know how many twins there are that have been separated at birth that you can study, but are there, in fact, can you go out and find twins separated at birth who are, in fact, nothing at all alike, or indeed, to the extent that you can, there are people that you can study, you have to say, yes, this really is a quite consistent sort of pattern that you find that they are indeed that much alike, even though they were raised in different circumstances.
In the United States, we don't have a central twin registry, and so the Minnesota twins were gathered in multiple ways, through newspaper advertising, through word of mouth, personal referrals, and so it really was not a sample in the strict scientific sense, but rather a collection of cases. But I will say that in the Scandinavian nations, where they maintain population registries, there you get an entire sampling and representative sampling of twins raised apart. Now, we don't know exactly how many twins are raised apart from birth, and the reason we don't is because, at least in the United States and other countries that don't have registries, we don't know how many are separated. We only find out about them once they are reunited. But another source of reared apart twins, which I find completely fascinating, and I write about this also in Indivisible by Two, is China. Because of the one-child policy, many twins were separated, particularly females, brought to orphanages sometimes on different days or found in different places, and then for some unusual reason were reared together. Parents, adoptive parents, recognize the similarities of those kids. In my book, I have a fascinating story about Lily and Jillian, who were adopted by separate Canadian families at 8 months. And when the parents were about to go to China and got photographs of the kids, they thought, gee, these kids look a lot alike and they have the same birthday. But the adoption agency said, no, we never separate Chinese twins. And yet, when the parents finally went to get the children, they looked exactly alike, contacted me, we did DNA testing, and they were, in fact, identical twins. And these wonderful families are working so hard to bring the girls together often so they can enjoy their twinship. And they, too, despite the fact that they're in different environments, are showing many similar behaviors in the way that they talk, in the way that they stand, in the way that they develop certain kinds of childhood illnesses. So I think that really, all of this work converges on the conclusion that genetic effects are pervasive, that is, that they affect virtually everything we can measure. But I can't give you an index of how similar they are because it varies from trait to trait. It's not as if identical twins are so similar or not similar, but rather they may be more or less similar in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Nancy Siegel. She is a professor of developmental psychology, and she is also director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University in Fullerton, and has been studying this subject, has been studying twins for quite a long time. She's the author of the book Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins. It's out recently from the Harvard University Press. Also, she's author of an earlier book published in 1999 titled Entwined Lives, Twins and What They Tell Us About Human Behavior. And she spends a lot of time talking about this subject and has written on it widely. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800 800- 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers, starting with someone in Indiana, and that's line four. Hello.
Hello. I hope this question or questions make sense. If they don't, you know, move on to something it does. Where I'm headed towards here is evolution theory. And I'm wondering, in the other parts of the animal kingdom, identical, if we can call them identical twins or identical fives or sixes as far as that go, whether there's been any studies in relationship to that, or is the genes so important that it doesn't make much difference about the environment as long as it's a normal environment where an animal would be raised. But in terms of the identical twins that you've looked at and have studied, does theory of evolution, in terms of its, you know, some of the rules and regulations that it pontificates, is there anything to say about that in regards to the twins that you might study? Thank you.
Okay. Well, first of all, if I understood your first question, twinning, identical twinning is fairly rare in the human population, I think for a number of reasons. And twinning in general is, because it's a more precarious pregnancy, it's risky for the children and risky for the parent. And in my book, Entwined Lives, in the first one, I do have a chapter on non-human twinning where I cover twinning rates across a wide variety of species. And actually, identical twinning is not really an adaptive process because it's an untested genotype. In other words, you're much better off in terms of survival possibilities if you produce different types of offspring, assuming that, you know, one type of genotype will do well in that particular environment. You could run the risk of producing two copies of the same thing that might not do well. Now, your second question, I think I can answer it if I remember what it was. I actually am fascinated by evolutionary psychology, and I use identical and paternal twins to test out various evolutionary-based hypotheses. And one is that perhaps we're predisposed to be more cooperative or altruistic towards individuals with whom we share higher degrees of genetic relatedness. And so in both of my books, I talk about the fact that identicals are more cooperative with each other than fraternals. I've done a series of experiments to show this, and so this all fits with evolutionary psychology, that we would, in fact, be predisposed to being more cooperative towards individuals who are close genetic relatives.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I've got two things I wanted to ask about, and then I guess I'll have to hang up because I'm late for something. But one has to do with a press release that came out last month from the Charles Darwin Research Institute. Professor Rushton, and his point is that people ethnic identity is very the way people prefer people of the same ethnicity is almost exactly the same thing as the kind of thing operating in family nepotism, and that there's he points out that, or he gives the opinion that the politics of ethnic identity is increasingly replacing the politics of class as a major threat to the stability of nations. And he says that studies of identical and fraternal twins show this really strong preference for similarity, that likeness leads to liking, for example. And I was curious if you knew anything about that or could talk about that. And then the other thing, and I'll have to hang up, is that in the Wall Street Journal last year, there was an article about epigenetics and how they were looking at a couple twins. One had schizophrenia and the other one didn't. And they talk about how it was the epigenetics involved that really made the difference between the two twins, and that is a different area that the mere DNA sequence does not capture. And these studies on twins help eliminate all that, too.
Right. I can answer both your questions.
Thanks.
I'll do it quickly
okay.
So you can hear it and get to where you're going on time. Professor Rushton's work is really nothing new. You know, the basis of likeness or cooperation or a good rapport has been studied in many, many contexts, not just ethnicity. In fact, we find that among friendships, people tend to choose friends that are similar to them, and we find that in cases of marital relationships, there's similarity across various things such as height, intelligence, and particularly family values. So that's really, I mean, that's been studied for many, many years. Now, when it comes to epigenetics, what we're talking about there is the pattern of gene expression, the pattern of which genes turn on and off, and we need to find out which kinds of events trigger that in one twin and not another. And there was a big study that was done that was written up in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and various other places that comes from a study of 40 identical twins in Spain. And what they found there was that by doing DNA studies and looking at the epigenetic profiles, twins who were most alike in their behavioral styles and patterns and lifestyles did have similar patterns of gene expression. They found that younger twins had more similar patterns than older twins. So this is a very fascinating and very meaningful way of thinking about the environment, the fact that environments can trigger genetic activation or inactivation. I think this is definitely a direction in which research is going to proceed.
All right. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the studies that have been done taking a look at identical twins that were separated at birth and raised in different families, different environments, and how in many ways they turn out to be similar, not identical in all kinds of ways. The degree of similarity is different depending on what sort of characteristic you're talking about, but that there are amazing similarities. If you take a look at then identical twins that were raised together in one family, I guess you might expect that they're going to be even more similar because the environment is the same. Although I'm sure there are also cases, and you have write about them in the book, of identical twins raised together where, in fact, in a lot of ways, they're really very different, which would sort of tend to surprise you.
Well, actually, overall, when you go across most traits, identical twins raised apart and together are really pretty similar. We find that in intelligence, the twins raised together are slightly more alike, and that may be because of more similar educational experiences. But one of the surprising findings has been in personality. Twins raised apart and twins raised together seem to be just about as alike, which suggests that the reason why family members in a family are similar is because of their shared genes, not their shared environment. Mm. But now, again, you can't talk about overall similarity. It has to be trait-specific. And we find, or at least some researchers have found, that for some personality traits, but not all, twins raised together may be less alike than twins raised apart, which sounds kind of counterintuitive. But it could be that twins are bouncing off one another. You know, when two people are in a relationship, they can never be exactly the same. One must be a little more dominant, one a little more submissive. So it could actually be that twins raised together in some ways may be less alike. Now, in my book, Indivisible by Two, I chronicle two families in which the multiple birth children are extremely different in certain ways. In one case, I talk about Agnes and Audrey, now Audrey and Andrew, because Agnes decided to change sex from female to male in her early 30s. And these are twins who everyone might think, gee, they're so different, but they're really quite similar in many, many ways, except for their gender identity, where one twin felt from a very early age that she really was a male trapped in a female body. But in terms of their personalities and their interests and the way they move their hands and when they talk, it's just, and the voice quality, really quite similar. I talk about another set of triplets who differ in sexual orientation. Two of the triplets, these are males in their early 30s, are straight and one is gay. And again, you can ask yourself, how can this be in genetically identical people? And we think that in both of these cases, what probably happened are some prenatal hormonal differences which might have affected brain development in the areas related to sexual orientation and gender identity, because these people do grow up in the same homes, and when you question the parents about how they raised them, well, the parents will talk about differences, but you have to remember that parents do not really cause behaviors in children. I always think of children bringing up parents as opposed to parents bringing up children, because parents do respond to and magnify or reinforce certain behaviors expressed by the children. So if, in the case of Agnes and Andrew, the parents treated one of the twins differently by giving them more boy-type toys and boy-type clothing, it wasn't that they made this decision to do it arbitrarily, but rather they responded to the natural tendencies that the child expressed.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly one of the, this question of sexual orientation is a very thorny one, and one that we don't seem to have very good answers for. People who are gay often say that it was just, it's just something that they feel that they are,
right,
and that they were born that
right
way, and that from when, as early as they can remember, that's just, they, that was who they were. Some other people raise questions about that and say, does parenting have something to do with it? Is it in fact something that people have some, they're in a position to make some choice about? So does looking at twins, does that help us any try to figure this out?
That's the point. It does help us, because if we were to look at one child in a family who became transsexual, it might be very easy for us to say, well, it's the way the parent treated the child. But because there are now twins, identical twins, where one is transsexual and one is not, then we can start to look at the particular events, both prenatal and postnatal, that might be linked to the differences in those behaviors. I think there's so much more information that we can recover in psychological studies by adding a twin-based perspective, because it just opens up many, many more avenues for interpretation.
A little bit past the midpoint of this program here. Once again, I'd like to introduce our guest. We're talking with Nancy Siegel. She's professor of developmental psychology. She's also director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University in Fullerton. If you would like to read about some of the work that she's done and about twins, you can look for her book, Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins. This book is published by the Harvard University Press and is out recently. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone calling here from Detroit who must be an internet listener, so we'll go right to them on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'm the father of three children. I have twin boys and a daughter that was born just 11 months later. And the boys have no idea who was born first. We told them that they were born at exactly the same time, just for peace in our household. But my one son, the middle child, is actually picking up middle child traits or things that I would consider middle child traits, you know, trying to get the attention, things like that. Has there been any research or study as to maybe the effects on other siblings or how all that plays in?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we find that birth order in twins really does not make much of a difference, other than to say that if it's a natural delivery, the firstborn child is usually having an easier time than the secondborn. Usually, if there's any kind of adverse consequence to the birth process, it's more likely to affect the second child. Now, I think you're very smart, actually, to not tell the children who was born first, because this can really create all kinds of competition and bad feelings. So to preserve peace in the family, I congratulate you. The fact that one child seems to be picking up on what you consider middle child characteristics, I don't think I'd put much confidence in that. Why that particular child should be clamoring for attention is uncertain. It seems to me, as long as you and your wife are not treating the children differently, in other words, some parents do give a firstborn twin extra responsibilities, extra status. I've seen that. And that could possibly create that kind of attention. But it sounds like you're really trying to downplay that. So where that hankering for attention comes from on the part of twin two is really uncertain. Now, your other issue about the effect of twins on other children in the family. What happens here is that if twins follow an older child, particularly if that older child is close in age, this can be very difficult for the older child, because not only is he or she dethroned by a second birth, but everyone loves twins, everyone gives twins attention, and this child can get severely left out of things. But in your case, because the single child followed the twins, even though they're close in age, she still is the baby and she's a girl. So this should really not be a problem in your case.
Okay, so it's probably just merely coincidence that my one son seems to pick up these traits then.
I would say so, without knowing the family in particular.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Again, thank you for the call, and others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the chapter on twins that were separated at birth, you have a really interesting, an unusual story concerns a pair of twins. And here we have a situation where a couple has twins, and when the twins are just 2 months old, they have to be put temporarily in foster care. And then the people get the twins back, and they were fraternal twins, so they really didn't look alike, but that does sometimes happen with fraternal twins, and apparently they never really thought that much about it. So later on, one of these guys goes to college, and he meets another guy that looks amazingly like him. And they talk, and they become friends, and they find out how much they have in common. And it turns out, the wind-up on the story is that, in fact, when these twins were in this brief period of temporary foster care, one of them was switched. And so this couple got back their child, but then they got back somebody else's child, and they raised the two of them, thinking that they were their kids, thinking that they were fraternal twins. So here we have a case of two people who weren't twins but were raised as twins, and then two twins that were raised separately.
Right. That is really an extraordinary story. And when the truth came out, it just changed the lives of so many people. You know, what's fascinating about this particular family is that we had a pair of people who grew up for 20 years thinking they were fraternal twins. And this is actually an interesting kinship that I do study, what I call virtual twins. And virtual twins are individuals who were raised together from infancy in the same home but are genetically unrelated. They can occur either when families adopt two same-age children or there's a biological child in the family and then an adoptee is coming into the family at about the same time. But most of these virtual twins know that they're not related. These fraternal twins, or these two people, believe they were fraternal twins, so that was an interesting difference. Now, what was fascinating was that when we studied them at the University of Minnesota, we found that the two identicals who were raised apart for 20 years were much more alike than the two who thought they were fraternal twins. And again, this is kind of what you expect as a twin researcher. It didn't really surprise me, but still it is a fascinating result to think about. But it really changed the lives of so many people because the twin who had been given away, who was raised as a single child by an adoptive family, had always believed his family didn't want him. So now he suddenly finds that his family wanted him all along. In the other family, we find that the boy who was not related, suddenly his parents aren't his parents, his twin is not his twin, his younger sister is not his younger sister. In fact, he's not who he thought he was at all. And he had a very, very difficult time initially in coming to grips with all this, although he did manage to find his biological family, married, had a child, etc. What was difficult for the adoptive parents of the single twin was that their child felt a much better fit with the other family. The adoptive family was a little kind of strict, very intent on cleanliness, on order, whereas the other family was a little more relaxed. And it seemed that he felt a much better fit with that particular family. But, you know, there's a lot of loyalty in both cases, and the families still all love each other, and it's not as if the single twin defected over to the other. He's still very much in touch with his adoptive family. But this is a wonderful example of how natural experiments can be so informative.
Yeah. Well, when you took a look at these two young men, the ones that were their parents thought they were twins, they thought they were twins, they were raised at twins as twins, when in fact that they were completely dissimilar. That it was the one of them was the child of some other two people. They're the only, and if there was any similarity between them at all, you would think the only thing that could possibly have produced those similarities would have been that they were raised in the same family.
Right.
What were they like, and were there ways that in which they were alike, and you would have to say the only way you could explain that is the way that they were raised?
Yeah, well, one thing that they shared in common was some interest in sports, although I will say that the twin in that pair, the real identical twin, was not so much interested in sports. He was more fascinated with sports statistics. But he did engage in more athletic activities because his so-called fraternal twin brother was very athletic. Now, when we looked at the other twin, he didn't engage in sports at all, but he had a love for sports statistics. So this is where there was some influence on the part of the so-called fraternal twin on the identical, the athletic ability. But other than that, they really led quite different lives. And what was fascinating to me was when the two identical twins finally met in their 20s, they were friends for 18 months until they finally told their parents. It never occurred to them that they were really twins until much later when they began to talk about the foster agency where they'd been taken in and, you know, their birthdays and a lot of things like that. After a while, they said it became too similar to ignore. But another fascinating thing is that when I looked at them, they looked exactly alike to me, and I'm thinking, how could you not know you were twins? But when you talk to most identical twins, they don't see the similarities.
Hmm.
And I'm always surprised when what I think are two identical twins tell me they're sure they're fraternal, because I guess we're just all responding to different qualities in the facial configuration.
Well, that's I had that same reaction as you, just as you said that. Guys, I'm sitting here, I have the book in front of me, and their picture is here. And the two guys who are identical twins, I would say, they look identically alike. And the other brother, the one who was somebody else, the child of some other couple, looks nothing at all like the other guys. And I would think that these two, Brent and
George,
when they looked at each other, would have this eerie feeling that they were looking in a mirror, but apparently it doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't work like that, or it works like that from moment to moment. But, you know, again, when many twins reunite, it's after a search, and they find the twin, and then they know that it's a twin. In this case, they had no idea that they were really twins. They thought they were just kind of similar. But they had such similar interests in odd ways. They both had fondnesses for strange board games. In fact, what brought them together was what was called a strategy club at Carleton University in Ottawa. It was a group of kids that got together to play different kinds of games. So it wasn't a very large club. And they had a fondness for something called Awful Green Things from Mars, a game I'd never heard of, but one that they thought was terrific. They had very similar tastes in music, and if one twin listened to a certain kind of music that the other one didn't listen to, the other one liked it immediately. So their tastes were so incredibly matched that, you know, it was just too striking to ignore after a while.
Yeah. What I'm curious about the experience of what you know about twins that were separated at birth and later were reunited, what sort of connections they have after the reunion takes place, and do they in fact, particularly given that you know, they may be similar in a lot of ways but were raised in different circumstances, do they in fact feel close? Do they maintain a close connection in ways that they hadn't before?
Yeah, it's a good question. I did a pretty large study on this when I was in Minnesota, comparing closeness and feelings of familiarity in reunited identical and fraternal twins. And I found that the identical twins did feel closer and more familiar than the fraternal twins, which didn't surprise me because that really mirrors what we see in twins raised together. But what was fascinating to me was that for both types of twins, they felt closer and more familiar with the newly reunited twin than with any unrelated sibling they were raised with. And so what this means is that just being raised with somebody, just sharing a lot of similar environmental events, is not going to lead you to feeling close. And I think this is important information for parents trying to raise multiple children, non-twin children especially, because, you know, you'd like all your kids to get along beautifully, and yet you're not, you just can't force certain kinds of loyalties or affiliations, at least not in childhood. I think that when kids get older, they sort of overcome those kinds of things. But certain people just get along better than others because they're more matched on certain traits. I think that's what these things show us. Now, the three pairs I write about in Indivisible by Two, Mark and Jerry the firemen, George and Brent the college students, and Oscar and Jack, the ones raised as Jew and Catholic, the first two pairs got along so beautifully in the beginning, and then towards the end of their lives, they kind of went different ways. And that's not too surprising, but in some ways, sometimes one twin is a step ahead of the other, and the other one tends to follow. In George and Brent's case, right now, George is working at a job. He's been very steady at it, and Brent is still kind of looking around for his niche, but it seems like he's sort of edging his way towards that. I think that probably Oscar and Jack, the ones raised as Catholic and Jew in Trinidad and in Nazi Germany, may be the most fascinating case of all because they met for the first time at 21. It was a terrible reunion. They had nothing in common, they said, and they didn't meet again until they were 45 when they agreed to take part in the Minnesota study. And it was their similarities, I think, and their twinship that actually drew them together. And even though after the study they would come together, take trips together, then they'd fight, vow never to see each other again, time would go by, then they'd decide, well, let's meet, and they would look forward to it so much, and they'd spend some time together, and then they'd leave again kind of angry at each other. And the pattern repeated up until 1995 when Oscar passed away. They had a real closeness to them, and yet they had a tension. And many people who wrote about them years ago but who did not know them as well as I did felt that it was the cultural differences that brought about the tensions. I don't think so. I think what it was is they both had these argumentative, dominant types of personalities, and that even if they'd been raised together, they just would have found different things to fight over.
If I'm thinking about this again, this whole question of the adoption and separated at birth. If you had a hypothetical situation where you had a set of twins that were being put up for adoption, would there be some sort of argument to be made to try and find an adopting couple that was willing to take both of them so that they could grow up together?
Yes, I really feel that twins should be placed together. I've seen too many weird apart twins who are angry and resentful at the fact that their separations were done for the convenience of, say, the adoption agency who just wanted to adopt children, or for couples who perhaps wanted only one child and not two. And so many of these twins we found would sort of act like children in a way to kind of recover the lost years together. So I don't know that there's an actual law in place, rather a sort of agreed-upon guideline that efforts should be made to place twins and triplets and quads in the same home, if at all possible. Now, I don't know if you know this, and I do write about this a bit in Indivisible by Two, in one of the sections, that in the 1960s in New York City, there was actually a study going on where twins were purposefully separated and then studied. And the way this came about was that there was a psychiatrist at Columbia who was an advisor to the Louise Wise Adoption Agency who felt, for some reason and without any research in place, that twins were better off separately so they could develop their own niche in the family. So when unwed mothers came to give up their kids for adoption, she made sure they were placed in separate homes, but the homes were purposely matched so that the parents were similar in certain ways and the family structure was similar in certain ways. And so there were five sets of twins and one set of triplets raised apart, and the families never knew, even though research assistants would come to the homes perhaps a week apart and see both kids, and yet the parents had no clue that these twins were separated. And many of them, when they finally met, because they were all in the New York area, and they were kind of destined to meet in a way, even though the researchers said they weren't supposed to, they were very resentful at the fact that somebody just decided arbitrarily or else through misguided reasoning to put them into different homes. Mm. So I really believe, I've seen too many happy twins once they were united, and twins who were raised together tell you it's such a wonderful relationship, such a feeling of trust and intimacy and security, that to not have that twin, it would just be a tragedy. And we see that, too, in a very sad way when twins die. I've done many studies on twins who've lost a twin, and in fact, in my book, Indivisible by Two, I chronicle the situation of a twin who lost her sister on 911 when her sister worked on the 97th floor of the North Tower. And this is such a tragedy, but what it does is it underlines the importance of that twin relationship.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things I wanted to go on and ask you about. Let me just, real quick, because we have about 10 minutes left, I should introduce you again to the people who are listening. Maybe there are some folks who have just tuned in. The guest this morning in this hour of the show is Dr. Nancy Siegel. She's professor of developmental psychology. She's also director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University in Fullerton and has been doing research on twins for a number of years now. In addition to her book, Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins, she's also author of another that is a survey of twins research. That book is entitled Entwined Lives, Twins and What They Tell Us About Human Behavior. That's published by Dutton in 1999. She is associate editor for the journal Twin Research in Human Genetics and was contributing research editor for Twins magazine. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There you just started to go toward the question I wanted to ask you about, and that is indeed when you talk about the extraordinary kind of bonds between twins, that invites the question of loss and whether and how it is twins experience that loss, and indeed would that somehow feel any different, or would it be more difficult if you lost your twin sister, for example, than whether you lost a sister who was not a twin?
Well, I have done some surveys with over 500 bereaved twins, and what I find is that the loss seems to be slightly more devastating for identicals than fraternals, although there's tremendous overlap. But again, this is what we see mirrored in the twin relationship. And we find that when individuals lose twins as compared to other people, I have them rank the grief intensity they experience for losing a twin or a parent or a non-twin sibling, the twins come out the highest. And the only relationship that comes out close to that would be that of a spouse. So really, I think that bereavement counselors have been overlooking sibling relationships in general and twinship in particular. You know, many of these twins have no place to turn, and what they do is they just turn to each other because bereaved twins do understand the loss better than anybody else, and I think they serve as each other's own best therapists. Linda McGee, the 40-year-old school teacher I write about in Indivisible by Two, was just not prepared for this loss. They were young. They were healthy. Twinship was something that she had always experienced all of her life, and suddenly to not have that there was just a devastating event for her, and she found that while her twin sister Brenda used to like to wear, say, bright socks and bright colors while she didn't, she began to take on some of those characteristics. And while she was typically the shy and retiring twin, she became much more vocal and outspoken as a way of educating the world as to what it means to lose a twin. In fact, there was someone in New York City who set up a support group for some of the 911 twin survivors, a very exclusive group, and no one was allowed to attend that except for the twins themselves. But what Linda tells me is that it was just so enormously helpful to her because she began to form these twin-like relationships with the other bereaved twins because they all understood exactly what was happening.
Mm. It's really, I guess it's one of these things that probably only one would have to be a twin to understand, and that I can imagine some people saying, well, I would, if I lost my brother or my sister, it would be devastating to me, and we're very close, and somehow maybe though wouldn't be able to understand that there would be another, things would go to another level.
Exactly.
If you were talking about a twin. And again, as I say, maybe only someone who was a twin would quite get that.
Exactly. That's what I suspect is the case.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Both of my grandfathers were parts of twins. I don't know how you say that. But anyway, on both sides, they were twins. And on one side, my mother's side, they hardly spoke to each other throughout life. On my father's side, they worked the same farm their entire life. Spent their last years in the same room in a nursing home. And it was quite common in the family to sort of grumble about how little they spoke to each other. But it always seemed like they were communicating very closely. Wondered if you had any comments on that or reflection on that in terms of experiences with other sets of twins?
Sure. You know, first of all, not every identical twin pair. I don't know if your grandfathers are identical or not. I'm assuming they are from the way you've presented this. But not every single pair is going to be close. We're talking about averages here, and you're going to get an occasional identical pair that's not close and an occasional fraternal pair that's extremely close. But in the case of individual pairs, sometimes it's difficult to understand why exactly they're not close, something that happened in their childhood or whatever. But even twins who claim to be sort of uninvolved with each other, I find are enormously involved. It's almost like they're each other's exclusive enemies. And you said that the pair seemed to not communicate, but really did. And that's not surprising for me to hear. I've known twins that they do nothing but argue, and yet they're on the phone constantly, and it's almost like they sort of can't live without one another. So their lives are enmeshed in certain important ways, regardless of the fact they tell you they're not close.
Yeah. Well, I always felt like on my father's side, who, you know, they were quite quiet but always around, that they had a level of communication that the rest of us just missed.
Well, I think you're quite right. You know, a lot of times, I mean, twins have their own styles, and I think of identical twinships as kind of mini-cultures with their own sets of rules and ways of doing things. And it could be that these were just quiet individuals. And, you know, often when twins are raised together, they form private words, private expressions, and gestures, which actually accounts for why many twins have delayed language development. But at any rate, they have their own ways of communicating, and many of them are nonverbal. They simply respond to the world the same way. They process information the same way. And so they probably understood things the same way without having to discuss it. That's what I think is happening in the case of your grandfathers.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. One of the things you talk about in the last section of the book that I think is really fascinating and also sort of mind-boggling is what happens when you have identical twins. You have two pair of identical twins who marry, and then they have children. Well,
right.
Their children are identical. I mean, the children of the two, or the two pairs are going to genetically aren't they? They're going to be the same genetically.
No. You have identical twins who marry identical twins. Yeah. The children from the two families are legal first cousins, but they are genetically full siblings, and so they're going to be much closer than ordinary cousins would be. If you have identical twins who just marry ordinary people, those cousins, those legal first cousins, are half siblings because they share one genetically, well, they share one parent who's genetically the same. So because of these, again, natural experiments, we can start to explore all kinds of interesting things. And in the case of the two couples that marry, I call that chapter marital math because you have to keep doing calculations in your head to figure out who's who.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating is that they have houses next to one another, an adjoining backyard, and one couple, when I wrote the book, one couple had identical twin boys, which in fact is rather unusual because identical twinning does not seem to be passed down in families. The more I look at this research, the more I suspect that there is a subset of families where identical twinning could be genetic. And they just had another little boy since the publication of the book. The other couple had two girls several years apart. But these children all look a lot alike. And in fact, the older girl from one family looks like the triplet of the two identical boys. But that's not unexpected because siblings in a family look alike.
Hmm.
And what's interesting is if you did DNA testing, you could never tell which parent had which kid. Impossible.
Well, that's, I guess, I did a bad job of trying to explain that. But I guess the thing is that you have, if you have two pairs of identical twins that marry and they have children, then the children, all of their children collectively, it would be like they were brothers and
exactly.
They were like they were siblings. It would be as if they had the same, all those children had the same parents, because in a way they did.
Exactly. In fact, in my other book, In Entwined Lives, I have this incredible picture of identical twins who marry identical twins, and they had boys on the same day. And so what this means is that not only are those kids first cousins, full siblings, they're like fraternal twins.
Yeah.
Because they're the same birthday.
Well, I think we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a caller here that we can't take, but we're simply going to have to leave it because we are out of time. However, I do want to say for people who are listening, if you would like to read on the subject of twins research, there are two books that I can suggest. One is Entwined Lives, Twins and What They Tell Us About Human Behavior. That was published in 1999, and it surveys twins and twin research. And then the more recent book, Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins. That book is just out now and is published by the Harvard University Press, both of them by our guest, Dr. Nancy Siegel. She's director of the Twin Studies Center at California State University at Fullerton. And Dr. Siegel, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. The broadcast today is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll rebroadcast an interview with journalist Angela Bonavolia, author of Good Catholic Girls, How Women Are Leading the Fight to Change the Church. That's at 1:06 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look at prices now on the Chicago Board of Trade. They are higher. December wheat, 3.12 and a quarter, up 2 and a half. March, 3.28 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. December corn, 1.94 and a quarter, up 1/2. March, 2.08 and a quarter, up 1/4. May